Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here with Liberty Coalition Canada. Today I get to interview a good friend of mine, Andre Schouten. Andre, thanks for coming on and dressing so spiffy as you normally do.
Well, you know, I'm really sorry about not having the jacket, but I still think it's a bit like summer, so I'm dressed down for you.
No, I'm dressed down for you. Yeah. Well, I dressed up for you. I went and put on a collared shirt and a tie so that we would match and feel good about each other. Good. So for our listeners to understand, Andre, who you are, Andre is the director of law and policy for an organization called ARPA Canada. Mm-hmm. And if you are a new listener or you've been listening to me for a while, of course, you know that Liberty Coalition Canada is interested in politics. Well, it was ARPA Canada and this gentleman across the video waves that started introducing me to the idea that Christians really needed to have a political voice. So Andre, I want to give you a little bit of time to unpack what type of organization ARPA is, explain for us what you guys do and how people can maybe start following you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks so much for the opportunity, Michael. It's so good to be on the podcast with you. And so ARPA Canada, so ARPA is an acronym. It stands for the Association for Reformed Political Action. So reformed referring to the theological tradition within Christianity going back to the Great Reformation in the 1500s and pulling on principles, biblical principles from that era forward that speak about, the Christian's role in politics. So ARPA Canada exists in order to educate and equip and encourage Christians, particularly from the Reformed tradition, but equip those Christians in Canada to be politically engaged. And then, so that's one part of our mission. And then the second part of the mission is to then also be a voice for Christians in the civil government, to lobby civil government, to submit policy reports to them, to intervene in important constitutional court cases and so on, to bring a biblical perspective to our civil governments. That's why we exist. And so we've been around for about 15 years now. We've grown from a one-man shop to a team of, I think we're 16 now, spread across the country with offices in the nation's capital here in Ottawa, which is where I am. And we've got offices in Southern Ontario, in Calgary, in parts of BC as well. So that's what we do.
That's awesome. And you are the director of law and policy. So explain for me what you particularly do.
Yeah, so I'm more focused on that second part of the mission where, so first of all, I'm a lawyer. I'm a licensed lawyer here in the province of Ontario. And so a lot of my work is more policy related. So if there's a new bill that's introduced in Parliament, I'm going to review that bill and see if it's good public policy or if it's going to be bad public policy. So for example, if Parliament introduces a law to legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide, I'm going to analyze that and explain why it's a bad law, how it impacts on our neighbors who are vulnerable, people with disabilities or advanced age or suffering from a particular type of disease, and how that law is going to impact them, and on how Christians can think through that issue and how they can borrow or lean on biblical principles about respecting all of life. And then also I will, with my colleagues and teammates, we'll do some lobbying and we'll engage normal everyday Christians who sit in a pew every Sunday or work at a coffee shop or in a business or a stay-at-home mom, whatever, engage them in the process as well. Get them to speak to their elected representatives and share their concerns, and we'll coach them on that and so on. Or if there's a court case that's going on in one of the courts, if it's an important constitutional question that's going to impact on the Christian community, we'll consider intervening in that case. So for example, some of our viewers might have heard of the Trinity Western University Law School case. It was a case involving a Christian university that wanted to start the very first Christian law school in the country. In fact, it would be the first non-secular law school in the country. They proposed it. It passed through all kinds of regulatory hurdles. The very final stage was having the law societies in various provinces to approve it. And the law society in Ontario and in BC said, no, we're not going to recognize your graduates because you have a Christian lifestyle agreement at the university. that was challenged in the courts. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada and ARPA Canada. And I had the privilege of doing it myself. We argued as interveners in that case, trying to advance good arguments in that case, you know, to advance the equality rights of Christians in Canada. So we do a little bit of that.
That's fantastic. I know how Trinity Western went. Why don't you share with our listeners how it went?
Well, I was trying to keep things chipper and upbeat here, Mike. But unfortunately,
we're both drinking coffee. Yes, that'll keep it chipper and upbeat. No,
that's right. Yeah, no. It unfortunately, the majority of the Supreme Court of Canada ruled against Trinity Western. They said it was reasonable for law societies to reject the application of the Trinity Western Law School on grounds of, you know, alleged discrimination against sexual minorities. Now, actually, if you tally up, there's actually three sets of court cases that went up to the Supreme Court. There was a court case and challenge in Nova Scotia that went to the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal. In Ontario at the lower level, went to the Ontario Court of Appeal and then Supreme Court of Canada. And in BC, a lower level BC Court of Appeal and Supreme Court of Canada. So in total, of all of the judges that have weighed in on that question, more judges ruled in favor of Trinity Western than against it. But really, at the end of the day, the only one that matters is the Supreme Court of Canada. And there, a majority of those judges ruled against Trinity Western. So it was definitely a hotly debated legal question for a few years in 2015 to 2018.
And just to summarize that then, so a Christian school professing a Christian worldview,
right,
trying to hold students accountable to that Christian worldview, mm-hmm, is not able to produce students that will be recognized in Canada.
Yeah, well, and particularly in the field of law, but you can see why we'd be concerned about that. I mean, if we say that about lawyers, then would we say the same about doctors or nurses or teachers or, you know, where does that end, right? And this was actually a complete reversal of what the Supreme Court of Canada had already said back in 2001, where in 2001, not even 20 years earlier, the Supreme Court had said the exact opposite. In an 8-1 decision, 8 of the judges had said about Trinity Western's School of Education, their teachers' college, they said, no, you can't shut down a teachers' college just because they hold to a Christian lifestyle covenant. That would be discriminatory. And now they've done the exact opposite in this case with regards to a law school. So
how much do you think politics affects the courts? You know, it's one of these areas that I'm learning about. In fact, I was just talking with a number of individuals yesterday saying, I wonder if the results of the election will actually affect a number of the COVID court cases that are going on or have been postponed until the fall. In your experience, are you able to give any type of insight into how politics affects our Canadian courts right now?
That's a really good question. And it's one that actually, I've debated with some friends of mine, other Christian lawyers as well. Like, so not just politics and law, but also culture and law. Like, which one precedes which, right? So is politics downstream from culture, or is it the other way around, or is it more like synergistic? You know, what affects what? Well, as a mutual friend of ours, Joe Boot will often say, culture is religion externalized, and I think that, generally speaking, what we see in the courts and what we see in parliament as they develop law, I think what we see there is, in a sense, downstream from where the culture is at generally. Now, that said, I think that's true at a worldview level, but yet when it comes to the actual imposition of law and policy, then usually you see the courts and parliament actually leading. So that's what I mean by that is that the courts and parliament will go the step further that where the culture is at religiously and culturally and worldview wise, you know, most of society is sitting here and they've adopted certain cultural presuppositions. Well, the courts and the parliament will take those presuppositions and bring them to their logical conclusion in a way that's more radical than the culture is actually ready for. But the culture's already adopted the underlying worldview that makes that okay. So, for example, it's the courts that legalized assisted suicide. The culture was already playing with those ideas. It was already relatively popular in the culture. So we say, oh, look what the courts did. They legalized assisted suicide. It's like, yeah, but public opinion was already there. That's why there's no major backlash. Or take abortion, for example. Parliament legalized abortion in 1969. And then the Supreme Court of Canada kicked that door wide open in 1988 when they struck down the existing abortion law. It allowed abortions in limited circumstances. Supreme Court of Canada said, actually, the law as it was crafted was unconstitutional. They struck it down. So there's no law whatsoever. And what did we see in the culture? We saw this massive increase in the number of abortions in Canada. Like, we didn't see the culture saying, no, we shouldn't go there. And that the abortion level would stay the same. No, we saw the abortions rise as the court struck down the law. So in that sense, I think Parliament and the courts lead the culture. And that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, the scriptures talk about that, how the prince or the leaders of the people, where they are at religiously, morally, the people will often follow. And so ungodly leaders lead to ungodly people in many respects. I think the book of Proverbs and some of the warnings in the Pentateuch and the history of the judges from ancient Israel, I think those all tell us that.
It's really your answer is so intriguing to me, because one of the biggest issues that I've seen in our church culture is that there is this great desire for people to see people saved. So see people come to an acknowledgement that we're sinners, that Christ died for our sins, and then we receive the grace of God. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there seems to be a significant reluctance to say that publicly and in the context of a specific issue. Mm. So I think what we're seeing now, as you know, culture becomes depraved, and in a democratic society, it's a little bit different than a monarchy, mm-hmm. where it seems like there is this relationship where the people go, the courts go further, mm-hmm. and then the next generation just starts at a you know, a lower moral line. And I have seen this year as an opportunity to speak the gospel and a Christian worldview into that void, in order to say, look, if there's no repentance of our nation, then the laws will just continue to get worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of clergy don't share my opinion on that. A lot of clergy want to say, well, you know, that's a civil matter. We don't speak to that. They want to say, it's not a gospel issue. You know, someone could be saved being of these, you know, different political opinions. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't seen a lot of interaction with the church. So as someone who tries to motivate the church, I would say you're further down the road than I am, but we're in this same kind of world where we want to see the church do something in the name of Christ, do something very well and be active in public. How do you respond to Christians who say to you, well, Andre, that's nice, but it's not a Christian's responsibility to be a political advocate or to be an activist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd say two things, and then I'm going to apply it to a third thing. So the first thing I'd say is that when people say that, well, the church shouldn't really be speaking into politics, the problem is that so many issues have become political. They've become political issues, not because they in their essence are, but because they've been made that way by the growing encroachment of the state into other aspects of life. I mean, if you said to a pastor, a Christian in the 1800s or any time from the 1800s back to the Roman era, if you said that, you know, abortion or the exposure of infants to the elements or whatever was a merely a political civil matter, they would have laughed in your face. They would have said, no, that's a moral issue. How we treat the most vulnerable, preborn children or infants, how we tenderly care for them, as is our duty under God, that's a moral and a religious issue first. It's not a political issue. Now, there's also a civic aspect to it, because a civil government has a duty under God to protect the life of all of its citizens, including the preborn child. But it's first and foremost a moral issue. Same thing with euthanasia. Again, if you look back over ancient history and over the history of the church, if you had asked any Christian, you know, how do we treat our most vulnerable elderly members of our community or those with disabilities? The Christian worldview says we treat them with respect and dignity and care, particularly our own parents. Honor your father and your mother means particularly as they become more feeble because of old age that we sacrifice of ourselves for them. Yeah. The civil government, their aspect, the aspect that they should be involved there is to ensure that their lives are protected. But now we've got a civil government federally who has said it's legal now for doctors to kill elderly people and to kill people with disabilities and to kill people with diseases. And that's legal. And so the church doesn't say, oh, well, it's now a civic matter. We don't have anything to say anymore. It's like, no, that is at its heart a moral matter. And we need to speak into that. So that's the first thing I'd say, is that as the state keeps getting bigger and bigger and intruding more and more into different aspects of life or abandoning laws and policies that were actually rooted in a Christian heritage, they've abandoned those. It's not for the church to say, oh, I guess those are civic matters only now and we don't have anything to say. Rather, the church should adopt the posture of a prophet that in a growingly secular and humanist society, that it's the church's role to be that prophetic voice to the civil government to say, no, this is wrong. This is immoral. There is judgment on nations that do these kinds of things, that sacrifice the lives of preborn children, that sacrifice the lives of the people who are inconvenient because of disability or because of old age and so on. We don't treat people that way. Every citizen, regardless of disability or age, they are made in the image of God and deserve full protection in law. And we're going to advocate for them. That there's so many Bible texts that talk about advocating for the weak, advocate for the vulnerable. That doesn't just mean within your church circle. It means in the society in which God has placed you.
It also doesn't mean only when it affects the church circle within the walls of the church either.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly another thing that, you know, even when it came to these vaccine passports, many pastors that I've spoken with would say, well, look, they didn't mandate it on the churches. So, and I keep reminding them, the church is not you and your staff. And when people, the church is, are your people out in the real world, mm-hmm. to whom you are shepherding. And you should be saying something to protect them in the real world. Not yeah. just pretending, oh, I don't have to get it, so it doesn't affect the church. The church gathers together to worship the Lord, but then the church, of course, is scattered abroad throughout the week to live in the real world. And
yeah.
So can we, just before you go on, do you have your point two and then your point three ready to go still? Yeah. Okay, just before you get there, though,
okay,
you said something that I want to make sure we do. Mm-hmm. So just in the spirit of prophets,
right?
I'm going to say, things like abortion and vaccine passports and euthanasia are just civic things. And then you and I are going to respond the way Christians would have. And you said years and years ago where we would laugh in that individual's face. Okay.
Right.
So I'm going to do it. You don't have to join me if you feel it's too disrespectful, but we got to do that. We got to, you know, just help people feel that. So abortion and euthanasia and people being able to, without any medical consent, force a vaccination upon Christians. That's just a political idea that Christians don't need to have anything to do with.
I can't believe you said that, Michael.
All right. Did everybody catch that? Okay. Andre, next point.
Right. So, So if we believe and confess that the gospel is good news, that it's coming from a good and gracious God who has not only created the universe, but he has also set rules and structures in place, not just for random reasons or for personal God deity reasons, but because he is good and he wants good rules and structures in place for the benefit of the people he's created. So if we believe that is true, then I think that it necessarily follows that a Christian, not only out of honor and love and devotion to God, but out of love and devotion to their neighbor, will advocate for good public policy. Bad public policy is going to hurt your neighbors. So we want to advocate for good public policy so that across this nation, people, Christian or not, you know, for my Christian neighbors and my Muslim neighbors and my Sikh neighbors and my secular neighbors, I want them to have the blessing of good public policy. So I do believe that God is a good God, and I do believe that the gospel is good news, and I do believe that the gospel applies not just to my personal life and my personal salvation with Jesus. I think the gospel applies to all of life. To quote one of my favorite theologians, Abraham Kuyper, there's not one square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not declare mine. It's all his. Every square inch and every nanosecond is his. He's king over it all. So, and he's a good king. He's not a bad king. He's not a tyrannical king. He's a good king. And that good king has good rules. And it's up to us to try to apply his rules in the civil sphere. Now, it's going to look different from time to time when it comes to some of the more minute aspects, right? Like, should the speed limit on the 400 series highways be 120 kilometers per hour? I think so. Or should it be only 100 kilometers per hour? Well, those are things that reasonable Christians and non-Christians can debate and discuss and so on. Like, it's not the minutiae around that we really need to worry too much about. Totally. But the bigger questions about what is the role of the state? What is its limits? What is the role of the other important institutions of society, like the family, like the church? How do these institutions interact? What does it mean to be human? What is the value of freedom? These kinds of questions we absolutely need to speak into. If we look just let's use the last 104 years, and we can see the dangers of Christians saying, well, actually, let's step back and not engage in civil government. Well, if you go back to 1917 with the Russian Revolution, 1949 with the Chinese Revolution, you can see that godless governments have a tyrannical tendency, very, very much so. And so, you know, if I look at communist Russia, if I look at communist China, I'd say a Christian looking at those things, they can live within that society, but they also want to make it better. And the way to make it better is to actually engage in the civic realm and to propose good changes. And one of those ideas for good change is going to come from, they're going to come from scripture and from Christian thought developed over the last 2000 years, what works and what doesn't, knowing the nature of man, the nature of God, and the nature of his created world.
It's really interesting when we were talking about the Kuyper quote. You know, we get a lot of that theology from the book of Colossians, both chapter 1 and chapter 2. Colossians 1:15-8, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn king over all creation, for by him all things were created, things on heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, powers, rulers, authorities, all things were created by him and for him. He is before all things and in all things, and in him all things hold together. And that text ends off with, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. And so it's just really interesting in there where there's a tension. He is supreme. The text clearly teaches that the Lord is supreme, mm-hmm. but there's also this sense that it also means that he should be supreme.
Right.
It that the kingdom has already come, but it is not yet in its fullness. So in that already, but not yet time, Christ is the king, but the presence of the people of God on earth is to bring him into his kingship, or encourage all people everywhere to submit to Christ the King. So we talk about that theologically, that he's already king, but there is a task, there is the Great Commission in all of its different facets, that our responsibility is to bring his kingship everywhere. So we need to bring his kingship into politics. We need to bring his kingship into law. We need to bring his kingship into medicine. We need to bring his kingship into the church. We need to bring his kingship into the family, all of these types of things. And I totally agree with you. I wholeheartedly, we have a wonderfully pure, holy, moral God whose ways are good. And if my neighbor lives under a king who lives under King Jesus, in a worldview sense, then that's blessing for our nation.
Absolutely. And obviously on this side of eternity, like, we're not going to achieve perfection. It's not going to be, we're not proposing a utopic vision here, in the sense that we understand that things are still broken. But we have to know the direction that we're going. And if you're like, you know, oh, well, like it's just going to be, you know, horrible until Christ returns. So let's just not do anything at all, or we don't have a calling to engage at all. Then we're not being salt and light in the culture, all aspects of culture. Culture includes politics or civics. And we're doing a disservice. I think we're not being the salty salt or the bright light that we're called to be. I think so. I think you mentioned the Great Commission too, and that's where I think so. If you ask some Christians, say, "Well, what's the Great Commission?" They say it's go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them. I'm like, well, actually, no, that's not where the Great Commission starts. It starts with the Lordship of Jesus Christ. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them and teaching them. And so that's like the Great Commission makes sense only under the all-encompassing authority of Jesus Christ as King.
It also changes the position into which we enter the conversation. We don't enter the conversation to make statistical analysis our God. We don't enter into the conversation to enter into some type of utilitarian ethic. We enter into the conversation as Bible believing, saved by Christ believers, renewed minds that bring authoritative goodness to, you know, whenever I talk to politicians these days, they'll be like, you know, they'll use words like right and good. And I'll say, well, where do you get the idea of right and good? You know, it's the age old question that, was it Pilate or Herod that asked it? What is truth?
Pilate. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd ask the Pilate question to politicians. Well, what is good? And they can't answer. And that's a perfect opportunity for me every single time to teach about the authority of Christ and the gospel. And as long as we're able to do that, we're going to have good impact and good influence.
Current crisis that we're living in right now, the big thing that Christians are wrestling with is freedom or liberty and its limits. And I think this is where we have to understand, this is where a Christian worldview helps. So Christians understandably perhaps have a knee-jerk reaction against too many claims to liberty or freedom, because in our culture today, our secular humanist culture, influenced by philosophical writings and ponderings of guys like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and worse thinkers who have come after him in his vein.
Yes.
They think liberty or freedom means radical autonomy, personal total autonomy, meaning I get to do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, however I want to do it, and nobody can tell me otherwise.
Right.
That's radical autonomy. And that's the justification behind abortion and euthanasia. That's the justification behind the sexual revolution. That's the justification behind the destruction, total destruction of the attempted total destruction of the institution of the family. And many others. And so there's this, I'm not so sure about freedom or liberty or claims to those things. Or they're like, well, wait a second, like, we don't have freedom vis-a-vis God to do what we like. God commands us to follow his commands, and he gives us prescriptions for our life. And so on. We got to obey and follow our God. So there's this discomfort, it seems, with many Christians around the concept of freedom. And so, I mean, I'm a lawyer. And so my gut reaction is to go to documents like our Charter of Rights and Freedoms and our Constitution and talk about those things. And in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the very first section, well, actually, the first section is a limiting section. It gives context and limits, reasonable limits, to all of the freedoms and rights and liberties laid out in the Charter. But the first substantive section is section 2, and it's called our fundamental freedoms. And I've been thinking about this one a lot lately, particularly in the last 18 months. I've been thinking about it, writing about it, reading about it a lot. And one aspect of our fundamental freedoms is that we as Christians have to understand what we mean by freedom. In a biblical sense, what we mean by freedom is the freedom to do not as we want, but the freedom to do as we ought. And I'm borrowing there from Lord Acton, an English parliamentarian who's written a lot about the history of freedom and liberty. And that's what he's talking about when he writes about it. He's an English parliamentarian, and he's writing about it in the 1800s. And when you look at our national anthem, actually, we got it on some of our ARPA merch and so on, like God Keep Our Land Glorious and Free.
Shameless plug.
So that God Keep Our Land Glorious and Free, that refrain from our national anthem. Well, what do we mean by free there? It's not freedom to do whatever we want, whenever we want. It's freedom in the Lord Acton sense, the freedom to do the things we ought to do, the things we're called to do. And again, that national anthem was written in the early 1900s. So this idea of radical autonomy hadn't really festered long enough for them to be meaning radical autonomy by freedom. They don't mean God keep our land glorious and radically free to do whatever I want to do. It's free to do the things we're called to do.
When you say freedom to do what we're called to do, freedom to work, freedom to tell the truth, freedom to worship, freedom to care for the poor, freedom to honor our parents, freedom... in fact, everybody, if you need to go to our ARPA's webpage in the next week, and you need to look up an article that Andre has written about all of the responsibilities that Christians have and individuals have. I just wanted to clarify that for folks, because like there are some real things that we're called to do, like care for our elderly parents, who are right now, it's illegal in certain contexts under these health mandates to do. You can't go in without, you know, being threatened of these people having to leave the facility that they're staying in and things like this. So I just wanted to clarify that before you moved on. I apologize for interrupting.
No, that's great. That's really, really good. And I've heard, as a little aside, I've heard that, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that when Pierre Elliott Trudeau, our former prime minister, father of the current prime minister, I'm not sure how long he'll be our current prime minister, but when Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who's the prime minister at the time that the charter was brought in, it was kind of his pet project. It's rumored that he said, and maybe this can be verified, I'm not sure, it's rumored that he said that with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, there should also be a charter of responsibilities. And I'm not sure really what he meant by that. He might have meant a more like kind of a socialist responsibility to the society as a whole, maybe. But I think there's actually an aspect to that that is correct. I don't know exactly what he was referring to, but from a Christian view, that the other side of the freedom coin is responsibility. With freedom comes responsibility, and that's what we're looking for, exactly like you said. And that's what we're seeing around us in the culture and have for decades now, is that as the state gets bigger and bigger and bigger, not only do we look at them, look to the civil government as our savior, a form of idolatry, but we're also looking at them to do everything for us, to feed our kids, to educate our kids, to do our charity for us, and so many other things. These are all responsibilities given to church as an institution or a community, or to families as a smaller institution and community. And we're abdicating those responsibilities and trusting the civil government to take care of all of that for us. That comes at a massive cost. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, I really want you to be able to finish that thought, but you actually opened up another idea. Yeah. Not only is there a flip of the coin where on one side is freedom and the other is responsibility, but they actually go hand in hand. You actually need freedom in order to fulfill responsibilities.
That's right.
You actually you and those laws, those documents were written to protect individuals from the state, not from other individuals necessarily, right, or maybe individuals acting and being coerced from an overreaching state. So it's deeply philosophical, all of these ideas, because they're rooted in this idea that we need to have a certain measure of autonomy in the proper sense of that word in order to act lawfully and responsibly, rather than just to move along with the herd wherever the top dog sheepdog wants us to go. Okay. Finish your thought.
So the new thing that I've been new-ish thing that I've been wrestling with, not wrestling with, just pondering in relation to the fundamental freedoms is that it's not only, I think, the fundamental freedoms protect not only the freedom to do as we ought, but they also protect our freedom to be who we were created to be. And it goes to who we are as human beings. So there's four fundamental freedoms. Stick with me here. Okay. So the first fundamental freedom is freedom of conscience. We were created as moral agents. That distinguishes us from the animals. We are moral agents. So freedom of conscience correlates to the fact that we were created as moral creatures. The second part of that first fundamental freedom is freedom of religion. We were also created as worshiping religious beings. To be human is to be religious. Even the secularists, they say they're non-religious, but they are religious. Secular humanism is deeply religious. That's what it means to be human, is to be religious. So fundamental freedom, protecting freedom of religion, respects that aspect of humanity. The second fundamental freedom is freedom of expression. Well, we were created to be expressive individuals. We express ourselves through things like song or music or written text or story. We're also inquisitive. So freedom of expression protects the right to study and to learn and to debate and figure things out, to discover and explore. So freedom of expression protects that aspect of our humanity. The third fundamental freedom is freedom of peaceful assembly. And again, if we look at our humanity, what does it mean to be human? It means to be relational. It means to be embodied. So our physical presence matters, and our physical presence together with other people physically present matters. That's the way we're created. So there's that aspect of humanity that's protected there. And the fourth fundamental freedom is freedom of association. Well, we weren't just created to be on our own, but to be collaborative and to be industrious and to be working together creatively to figure things out and develop things and build things and so on. Well, that's all that happens under associations. And so when I've been looking at the fundamental freedoms for the last few months, I'm like, that it's not just protecting our right to seek after the truth. It's not just protecting our right to pursue the things we ought to pursue, do the things we ought to do. It actually is protecting who we are as human beings. In other words, unjustifiable infringements of fundamental freedoms, I would argue, are actually inhumane in the most basic sense of that word. They treat the citizen as subhuman, as non-human. It ignores aspects of our humanness that should not be ignored. And we're seeing the effects of that out there over the last 18 months. Why is suicidality through the roof in the last 18 months? Why are addictions up like crazy in the last 18 months? Well, it's because there's these aspects of our humanity that we've ignored. We don't even think about, we don't even talk about them. We've taken them for granted for decades now. They're ignored and we remove them from the people, and then the people react in these ways, and we shouldn't be left scratching our head. We should, especially Christians, we should look around and say, well, of course, because this is not the way we're created to be. This is, you know, anyway. So that's a thought that I've been thinking about a lot in the last few months.
No, I think you're connecting two ideas. You're connecting our identity with our createdness. Like you're connecting the fact that we are not just animals the way that the secularists would like people to believe. And you're saying that has real ramifications in the world. And we as believers would have been saying that since creation, you know, the people of God would have recognized our the Lord's design, you know, even as you talked about the relatedness, right? There's entire volumes of theology about how we are created as relational beings because our triune God is relational in and of himself, Father, mm-hmm. Son, and Holy Spirit. You're also connecting a dot for people that I harp on a lot, and that is simply that we manifest our lives in the real world. So much of Christian theology or Christian exegesis from the pulpits right now tends to be theory and not application into the real world. And of course, the Reformed background, the Reformed tradition, I would even maybe use the word reformational tradition, which is a bit broader than maybe technically the way that ARPA would use the word reform, but fairly close to it,
yep.
believes that the transformed believer reforms the things around him or her. Mm-hmm. And in all of these ways. So no, I think that's significant that you're reflecting at that level of depth, Andre. I'm sure an article is going to come out of this, and I'm sure I'd love to promote it. Folks, before we go any further, because I really just want to get silly with my good friend. We've been very serious, and Andre is a good encourager in my life, so I want to have a little bit of fun with him. But before we go any further on that, I do want to say Andre gives a State of the Union address. Andre and I are both fellows at the Ezra Institute. I've heard him give this a number of times. Even one time he gave it without having a tie on. He did it. He did it without having a tie on. But if you are, the lawyer says shit. If you've never heard of ARPA or you've never had Andre come and speak at your church about the connection between our Christian worldview and political outcomes, or just understanding what is going on as secularists attack this country, you need to have Andre come and give his State of the Union address. And Andre, if people wanted to book you to do that, how would they do that? Just go through the ARPA website?
Yeah, or you can probably email me. It would be the best, Andre. So that's A-N-D-R-E at arpacanada.ca, arpacanada.ca. And then myself or my assistant, Trusa, would probably get back to you quickly, and we'll see what we can do to make that happen.
I'm telling you, you'll go from zero, meaning Jesus doesn't care about government at all, to how do I become the next Prime Minister of Canada in one sitting with this man. Andre, I've just been so overjoyed by the topics we've covered so far. I think you've brought clarity on a number of things. Why don't you share, we'll go back into the depths a little bit. Why don't you share the top three or four things you're concerned about, maybe without giving your entire State of the Union address away. What's ARPA watching right now? What are you concerned about coming down the pike? And I know that when you say, what are you concerned about, can you give us a little bit of time expectations? Like, literally, this is kind of humorous, but literally there is arguments around the country among pastors as to whether or not persecution is 50 years away or 23.1 years away, or if the tribulation has started yesterday and now there's 7 years, right, or if we're in it already. So can you help us?
Yeah. So I think there's a few things we're concerned about. So one is the mandatory nature or the coercive nature of some of these vaccine policies that are coming out. That's concerning to us. ARPA Canada actually does not take a position on the efficacy or safety of the vaccine. So the question, the medical aspect of the vaccine, good, bad, or otherwise, we're not wading into that. But from a public policy perspective, we'd say coercive policies like what we're seeing spreading across the country, they're very problematic and we'd say even immoral in certain situations. I would say that if a person has a bona fide reason not to have the vaccine, like they've thought about it. So it's not laziness. If they've thought about it, they've researched it, and they have a medical reason or a ethical reason or a religious reason to not take it, then that should be respected. And they shouldn't lose their job over that. That's coercion. And it's not right. So that's one issue we're concerned about. Another couple issues looking at the federal level anyway, looking past the election, we're really concerned about certain hate speech legislation and proposals to really clamp down on freedom of expression. It's going to have a direct impact on things like sermon streaming, the sharing of Christian resources online, as it relates to the application of the gospel to our human sexuality or identity, the application of the gospel to questions of critical race theory, and so on. So freedom of expression, definitely concerned about that. C6, as you mentioned already, we expect it's going to come back. It's a conversion therapy ban, but they define conversion therapy so broadly as to include just conversations with parents and children around sexuality and identity and sexual ethics, or conversations between pastors and their and the people who attend their church. So conversion therapy is going to be a big, big issue for us. And then a third one I'd say is euthanasia. There's been a massive expansion of euthanasia just in the last year or so. And so out of love for our neighbors, Christian or not, who have a disability, who have advanced age, who are struggling with a particular disease, out of love for them, we want to make sure that if they ever have suicidal thoughts, that they're not right away offered assisted suicide, but rather suicide prevention and then the alleviation of pain and suffering through things like palliative medicine and compassionate care. And we as a country are hurtling down the road of ableism, where we judge the value of a person based on how able-bodied or productive they are as a member of society. Like some of the things that some politicians have publicly said about people with disabilities or suffering from a particular disease is horrifying. It should shock the conscience of the nation, and it hasn't, probably because a good chunk of the mainstream media is fully on board on that issue. So definitely we're going to be working on that a lot post federal election. Try to rein in that runaway train.
Two thoughts then, or one question, one thought. So Bill C6, mm-hmm. Can you just tell us where is it? Has it passed all three readings and it's just in front of the Senate, or where are we at with C6?
Yeah. So the good news about the election being called is that C6 is dead. It dies. So Bill C6 made it all the way through the House of Commons and into the Senate, and Senate was beginning to study it. But because the election is called, any legislation in front of Parliament dies. Parliament actually technically ceases to exist. So we don't have a Parliament right now, and it only gets constituted again after the election. So the 43rd Parliament is gone and done, and it's finished, and the results of the election to start the 44th Parliament. But all of the parties, the major parties anyway, have plans in their platforms to introduce a conversion therapy ban. That the key will be, how do they define that issue of conversion therapy? Do they define it broadly, so it's going to capture pastors and parents, or are they going to define it very carefully and narrowly to focus on a particular type of coercive, torturous procedure that has been long discredited? Which definition are they going to use? One's particularly dangerous for the Christian community.
Okay, and then I wanted to make a statement on the ableism, and we're already seeing this with the preborn. Mm. I think people would be shocked if they heard the comments that doctors are just in general consultation saying to couples with a child after there's been some type of genetic testing or there's been some type of complication. I think it would chill people to see how quickly human life is being discarded on the premise that production equals joy. You know, they won't have a joyful life, and there's this implied productive. And then how slippery the slope really is with the aged or the depressed, how quickly it goes from, well, you should consider this as an option, to, no, you know what? You're really not pulling your weight. It would be better. Mm-hmm. And so ableism, thank you for touching on that. That's such an important topic. So I'm going to sign off right now, everybody. Andre, it was just fantastic having you on. We got to have you on more often. Thank you for coming and being with us. make sure, folks, that you check out ARPA Canada. They've got a ton of great resources. And again, if you are interested, you ought to be interested. You're free to do what you ought to do. And that is, you ought to invite Andre or someone from ARPA Canada to come to your church and explain the state of our union and why we Christians have a great opportunity to preach about the moral character of the Lord, about his salvation, and also about his good and just rules in this public and very real world. So invite Andre to come. Thanks for being on today, Andre. Have a great day.
Yeah, it was so good to be on with you. Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
You're welcome. I'll see you later.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.